Hey, Talkhouse listeners, it's Josh Modell. Instead of encouraging you to listen to podcasts today, I'm here to encourage you to read something great. The particular something I have in mind is the second issue of the Talkhouse Reader, the print zine spearheaded by our fantastic music editor, Annie Fell. This issue is focused on the intersection of food and music, and it features contributions from Maddie Matheson, Coleman Domingo, Squirrelflower, Sam Evian, The Blessed Madonna, and more. There are pieces about eating while on tour, the gentrification of food, cooking as a creative catalyst, and much, much more. You can order a copy today, along with the first issue, at store.talkhouse.com. Please do check it out.
Hi, this is Carrie Brownstein.
This is DJ Premier.
This is Darren Aronofsky.
You got the RZA right here.
Rose McGowan.
Right here.
Aisha Tyler.
A Tribe Called Quest.
Fred Armisen.
Prince Paul.
Javier Munoz. Seth Meyers.
Frankie Cosmos.
Flying Lotus.
Hi, we're Chaim. And you're listening to the Talkhouse Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Talkhouse Podcast. I'm Josh Modell. On this week's episode, we've got a pair of musicians from the UK who recently collaborated for the first time, Dana Margolin and Joseph Mount. Now, Mount has been the driving force behind the band Metronomy since 1999, and he's found success not only with a series of winning electropop records, but also by remixing tracks for big names like Franz Ferdinand, Gorillaz, and Lady Gaga. If you're unfamiliar with Metronomy, a good place to start is 2008's Nights Out, which is a sort of concept album about, as you might guess, a night out. But Metronomy's catalog is intriguingly all over the map. The band's latest is called Small World, and it features a much gentler side of Mount's songwriting personality overall. It also features a stunning duet with the other side of today's conversation, Dana Margolin of Porridge Radio. Like Metronomy, Porridge Radio really started out as a solo project, but grew into more of a band situation, though each is still the brainchild of one person. Margolin started recording under the Porridge Radio name back in 2015, but it was her second proper studio album, 2020's Every Bad, that really made the world stand up and take notice. It's a powerful, intense record that stands alongside current heatseekers like Dry Cleaning and Wet Leg, but that has a stamina all its own. Margolin is just about to release the follow-up to Every Bad, an equally bracing and incredible set of songs called Waterslide, Diving Board, Ladder to the Sky, once again on the Secretly Canadian label. Check out a little bit of a song called Back to the Radio.
And I miss what we were, but you've closed yourself off to me. We sit here together, the same as we've always been, laughing and talking, but I want to cry to you, laughing and talking, but I want to cry to you. Sit still, do nothing. What if it mattered? I'm trying to help without breaking or shattering.
In this conversation, Mount and Margolin talk about their collaboration, about the time that Mount almost but didn't quite catch Margolin performing, and about the importance of lyrics. You'll hear how eczema factors into a new song. They also get to Kierkegaard, Michael Stipe, and Margolin's desire to, but inability to, write a, quote, nice little love song. Enjoy.
I've been spending a lot of time with your sister on tour, because I don't know if you know this, but she's a dancer.
I do know that she's a dancer.
And she's dancing with a queer performance artist called Lynx.
Yes, and she sprained her ankle just last week on tour with you.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was thinking about how good it was having a kind of a support band that was like really amazing at making the crowd like go crazy.
Yeah.
Like each night Lynx was getting them, working them up into a frenzy for us.
They really do that. They really like build up this mania in the crowd. It's amazing to watch. Just like in London, everyone was completely losing it.
Yeah.
But it's hard to follow.
Exactly. So we had to sort of, kind of try and follow it. So they were almost too effective as a support band.
Yeah.
And then I was asking you about if you had a support band.
We don't, but I really want to bring another band with. I think like I'm always trying to find bands who I love who can come and play shows with. Because I do find on tour, my favorite thing about tour is getting to watch other bands play. I love just like being in a room where there's live music. Like it's the thing that feels the best in the world for me. And so like, you know, on tour when you're really exhausted and you just like, you're not really in the mood to play a show yet. And you're about to play a show and you've like just had dinner and you're kind of trying to digest it before you play. And like, you've not really slept properly. And you just watch a band that you love and suddenly it just like feels better.
It's quite romantic, really. It's a long time since I've felt like that.
since you enjoyed.
No, but it's funny because I was like, it's funny you talk about that because we were playing some quite nice venues and they often have catering and like the links and everyone were getting the catering as well. But quite often they were waiting until after the gig to eat. And we were like, oh, of course, because because if you eat at 7 and then you're on stage at 8, you're a bit sluggish.
Yeah. Well, that's always the worst thing about being a support act on tour is that your timings are always so bad because you have to arrive just before, like your sound check is later and your stage time is earlier. So you actually have to cram the whole bit of the day into about 3 or 4 hours. Whereas when you're headlining, you kind of get there early, you do your sound check, you have like a few hours, everyone thinks you're important because you're the headline band.
Yeah.
You go on your walk around town, have your dinner, come back, watch the band. It's all very relaxed.
Well, you are very important as well. It's not that you think you are, it's that you are actually.
Do you think you're very important?
Yeah, no, of course not. But it's nice to feel wanted, isn't it? It's nice to feel a bit special.
It is. Like for years, we were just playing like a million shows all the time, supporting everyone. So we're kind of at this point now where we're just about to start doing this in a way that we're like, we're an important band, whereas we've never been important before.
I remember when we got offered like a first decent support tour. Like, who was the first decent band that offered you a support tour?
I did a few solo support tours. I supported Florist on tour on my own. Okay. If you know them, they're like a New York band and they're really good. And I also supported Ian Sweet on a tour, but that was just Georgie and I from my band did that. I kind of used to just say yes to everything and just go for it and be like, okay, let's figure out how to play the show as a two-piece now.
I mean, I just remember sort of like when we got offered, we did a block party tour and this was like a very long time ago.
That's very cool.
Like, we didn't have enough material to play for like 45 minutes, which is what they were required us to do. But it was, I remember just thinking like, oh, wow, this is a real, like, it was a taste of the sort of real thing. And then it suddenly felt like, oh, well, we can't go back to supporting any old chumps.
Any nobodies.
Yeah.
Only indie royalty from here on.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's true.
There was a point where it's like you say yes to every single show and then you get to a point where you can start saying no to things and you can start being a bit picky about, even though it's a support tour, you can say, okay, well, I'm not going to just support anyone. I'm going to support only people I love. Like, I'm not going to do the show unless it acts. But you have to kind of reach a certain point, I think, for that to start to be okay. Because I feel like the first few years, you're just like desperate for anything.
When we were doing like that block party support, and we did so many different sports, like, but when we did that, like, I felt like maybe we were finding some of our kind of audience. Like, I felt like maybe sometimes there were people who weren't just like, oh God, when a block party playing? How did it feel doing what you do in front of like people who have no idea potentially who you are? Like, do you feel like you kind of won people? You kind of gained fans and stuff?
I think we kind of have a weird thing where we're a very intense live band. Have you been to a show?
I did accidentally.
You accidentally came. Oh yeah, you accidentally. Maybe we should also explain to people how we know each other, which is simply from our collaborative track, which we did together, which was the first time we met.
For my record, yeah.
But you did come to the Hope and Ruin after I'd played a show about 6 years ago.
I have a very good memory for gigs and
really
and venues, and the more I do not the more I think about it, the more I sort of remember. I think I arrived at the end of your show, and I'm sorry for that, but I wasn't.
It's okay.
I was kind of going to see the band after.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, my friend worked there and he was like, oh my God, Joe from Metronomy is here, oh my God. And we were all like, wow. So you had that celebrity status amongst the the Brighton DIY scene.
There you go.
I do love that somebody else noticed that and mentioned it to you as well.
Yeah, that I was there. They were like, oh, so have you known Porridge Radio for a long time? Because I saw you at their gig at the Hope and Ruin in...
Can you imagine?
I know, it's brilliant.
It was what, like 2014 or something, maybe a bit later.
Yeah, so I'm a sort of old Porridge Radio fan. from then.
Yeah, you go way back. Wow, that's really amazing. You've really stuck with us through the years. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I like to support bands.
You know, I am actually I'm an old time Metronomy fan from probably from your Block Party tour days, because I used to read the NME and I remember reading about Nights Out and buying the CD when it came out.
Amazing.
And being a massive fan. So that is my thing that I tried to keep cool. no, it's cool. I was on your track, it's fine.
When I was thinking about things I wanted to ask you about, not that it's really relevant, but I was sort of wondering how old you are. But you don't have to tell me. You could show me with hands because
I'm 28. I'm 20, very, okay. I have no shame. So are you 10 years older than me?
I'm actually 11 years older than you. Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay.
I was going to ask you about that. But then hang on. I don't want to
lose the thread.
Lose the thread, which was that. So I think I saw a bit of you in 2014. And and then I'd heard you on the radio. And then the only live performance I've seen apart from sort of online is recording you. And that was it, really.
Mm, yeah.
So I've yet to have the full experience.
So I guess we are quite an intense band. I think a lot of people kind of come to the show, comes for the support. And then if they see us, they're a bit like, oh, that was a lot. And wow, I am quite cocky and I think I should reel it in. So I will be less cocky. But I think that we do surprise audiences who haven't come to see us. Often people be like, oh, I saw you by accident and it was great. But I think maybe that's because we are a very live band. The live chemistry is very important to what we do.
The kind of image I've built up, or the image I'd built up of you previous to recording.
Yeah.
Was, I think, and it's that thing which is quite, I guess, quite kind of the thing that you realize about musicians and whether it's kind of bands or pop singers or whatever, but basically people present to you what they want to present to you. Everything is kind of considered, you know what I mean? The kind of intensity of what you do is such a sort of huge part of how I think you're sort of seen and consumed. and when we were hanging out for the day in Margate, and how it was just not intense at all.
Really fun. It was such a lovely day.
But it's kind of, I guess recently I've been thinking quite a lot about that, about how the image that people want you to have of them, and things like humor and humor in music and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And kind of enjoying seeing how people kind of play with it. I quite like when we were working together, when it came to the actual recording, that's when I saw the thing which I'd sort of been expecting to see at the pizza shop.
Yeah, you create a persona, if you are an artist, you create this artistic thing that you put forward, or a way of that you want people to see you. And I think especially because the music I make is very deeply emotional, I want to make people feel a bit uncomfortable sometimes, but also I really like meeting people and talking to people. And I find often there is a bit of a dissonance between how I am as a performer and then how I am as a person. But I think maybe that's kind of the fun, is that when you are a performer, I don't know if you find this, you can decide who you want to be in your song, and you can decide who you want to be live, and you can be that thing, because you're creating an entire world that your art exists within. And then outside of that, you can be whoever you are in your day to day, because again, you're creating an entire world that is your real life.
I think in a way that's probably where I've suffered from not really thinking about it enough. I'm in charge of what I want people to see and think.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I don't really care what they see and think. You know what I mean?
Well, that's really nice.
But it's still a decision.
I was going to ask you about this, actually. I guess there's elements where I've been told in real life that I'm too intense, and that's something that I always want to push or go too far, go too deep. And I find that I can channel that part of myself into my music, but I need to have other places where I can hide a bit. And so I'll maybe put this element of myself that's incredibly vulnerable into a song, but I will still create a space outside of that where I can maybe put something that I don't necessarily feel ready to share.
Mm.
And I was wondering if because your music is different to that, do you find that you're putting something in that is maybe a performance of your own personality or a performance of an artistic idea, or, and then you need to have another place that you put something else that could potentially be more private? Or
it's weird because I've started to intellectualize like what I do a bit more, much to the probable surprise of people. I've realized what I've done. And like when I, like the first album I made, I didn't sing on it at all. And like the second one I did, I made on my own. And it was like literally like what you hear in my first kind of attempts at singing, really. So that's like some of the first songs I ever like wrote with words, and the first time I ever sang. I've sort of learned how to do what I do in quite a public way. So like if you listen through all of the records, like it's an incredibly like kind of bare document of how I've got better or whatever,
yeah,
or worse in making music, but like,
or worse, different.
But the one thing you can't like deny is that it is like a faithful record of like my life in a way. And so, however much of myself, in terms of like literally like in lyrics, however much of myself I give away, kind of doesn't necessarily matter because everything else is so exposed, like all the other bits are just there.
Yeah.
So I kind of, I've gone from thinking that I was quite, that I kept a lot of myself out of what I do for like, and put it in another place, to realizing that actually I kind of put like everything into it in a way.
Maybe I think I'm hiding some things, but I'm not, like it's all kind of visible. I think even unconsciously, sometimes you just channel everything that you're doing at that moment. Or like, I find that often, like in interviews, people ask me about kind of like, what were the themes that you were trying, or like, what did you learn from this record? What did you, and I'm like, well, it was just like a few years of my life. So I learned about a million things about everything. And like some of that was channeled into the record, you know?
I think that quite often that's how it works. And people are looking for more explanation, but it is quite just like, oh, well, that's what I got up to. That's what I did. There it is. Like,
there's the song.
I wrote some songs.
Exactly.
Hey, this is Josh Modell, host of the Talkhouse podcast. We love it when musicians come on the show and talk about process, and often they'll get into the nuts and bolts of being a working artist, which can sometimes be fun and sometimes feel more like a business. Well, this episode of Talkhouse is brought to you by DistroKid, which is an amazing service for musicians looking to get their songs out into the world in an incredibly smart and cost-effective way. For the past decade plus, DistroKid has made it easy to get your music on all the streaming services, including Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Instagram, and more. You keep 100% of your earnings minus a flat yearly fee, which is a better deal than you'll find anywhere else. More than a million artists use DistroKid, and the latest version of their app is better than ever. It includes features that make it easy to see your account details, including the money you've earned, as well as to seamlessly edit things like lyrics and metadata across platforms. There's even a feature called Instant Share, which allows you to easily share files with your bandmates, booking agent, playlist curators, and more. Distro Lock allows you to protect your songs. DistroKid users get a YouTube official artist channel too. The list goes on. The DistroKid app is available on iOS and Android. Go check it out today.
Season 3 of Sing for Science is out now. Join me, your host, Matt White, as I investigate the limitless connections between science and music with some of today's greatest minds in science and biggest names in music. Check out our new episodes with Jeff Tweedy, Nick Kroll, Margot Price, and more as we learn about everything from psychiatry to physics. Sing for Science is co-produced by Talkhouse and available on your podcast platform of choice.
Your new record,
which I leaked to you.
Which you leaked to me, and I've just leaked now to everyone else.
Who have you leaked it to?
To the world.
Okay. Have you put it on a nice torrenting website?
I did. I put it on a torrenting website, and it's going really well.
Wonderful.
But I was listening to it, and I was very much enjoying it. And I guess, like, the thing that strikes me is that in quite a few of the songs, right, I think, like, you're sort of a millimeter away from like a sort of like a pop smash.
All I want to do in my life is write a pop smash.
That's what
I want to do, it, and we're working towards it. It's getting there.
I remember, like, the first time I heard, and I'm not saying it reminded me of this, but the first time I ever heard Pavement was because of that song. It's called Stereo, isn't it?
Yeah. I love Pavement. Feel free to compare us.
I'll get to the comparison.
Okay.
But like, when I first heard that song, I was like, oh my God, this is like, and I'm talking about Stereo. I was like, oh wow, this is like that other stuff I've been into, like Weezer, or it's like Green Day or something like that. I might be wrong in terms of timings. But I remember just thinking like, it sounds like kind of pop punk to me or something like that. And then I obviously listened to like lots of other Pavement, and then you realize like they don't always do this kind of thing. A lot of the other stuff's way less accessible. But anyway, I was just thinking like, you know, one of these days you're probably going to have a kind of like song, like a crossover smash hit. And I was just wondering if that's what you want.
The Look, for example. Well,
yes, exactly.
Would be
The Look.
Direct the comparison look. There. Yeah. I mean, I would love that because it's fun to bring people in under one pretense of like, oh, our music is like this. And then they realize that it's actually like a lot of other things. When you have loads of different ideas and you love loads of different genres and different artists, they all tend to kind of seep in different ways. And it's fun to be like, okay, this song just not on purpose, but it just turned out this way, like completely fits into this genre, and this other one on the same album completely fits into another one, but they're both very obviously my songs. I think I can also see it in your music, actually, the kind of like, you've got different vibes.
Yeah, different vibes.
It's fun to have that. I would love that to happen, yeah.
But do you think there's any part of you that subconsciously would feel like, oh, this is too, this is like too easy or something? You know what I mean? Like, do you think that would ever happen?
And actually, every time I try and write a song, I try going being like, I'm going to write a nice little song now. And I'm like, this one's not going to be really, this one's not going to be miserable. Like, I'm like, I'm just going to write a love song and it's just going to be a nice love song. And I just like, every time I can't do it. And I feel like with time, I will get there and I will write a happy little song.
I think some of the biggest pop smashes ever are not like happy songs. I think lyrically, a lot of the sort of biggest songs ever are quite probably sad. When I've done stuff previously, I've like stopped short of certain things because I felt like, oh, that's like, that's not cool, or that's not kind of me, you know what I mean? When in fact I probably should have just been like, ah, fuck it.
I keep telling people this is the year of cringe, and I'm kind of embracing that. And I think lately what's been really interesting and exciting to me, just from a creative point of view, is just being like, okay, well, this thing is really scary, I'm going to do it. Or like, even just in my life in general, it's like, this thing terrifies me, I'm going to do it. Okay, I dare myself to say that thing that I don't want to say. And then I do it. And so it's quite, I feel like maybe music, the way that I'm writing songs, is also kind of an extension of that, which is like, you know what? Like, I'm just going to give everything I have to give, and I'm not going to hide it. When I came to record Hold Me Tonight with you, and I changed the lyrics because I was embarrassed by them. And that was kind of like an example of that, where I think actually it was really helpful for me for you to just say like the most heart on sleeve stuff is the best stuff. Like the cringe stuff is the good stuff. That's what people like.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it kind of let it click for me in a way, which is if I've written something and I'm sharing it, I just need to like go all in. I need to give everything. If I'm going to give something, I should just give everything, and I should dare myself to just take that like emotional risk and take it to the next level. And so that's kind of something that I try to do actively in music and art, just like make myself incredibly vulnerable and then see what happens after that.
But I think that's like, I've spent a lot of time like, you know, like sometimes when you hear if you hear a song and you hear a lyric and you're like, wow, that's really clever. Like, or that's really kind of beautiful. Like, I wonder how they came up with that. And then you realize either by sort of maybe, I don't know, like working with them or reading about it or something that actually, yeah, it was just like, it was a root one lyric. Like I was listening to your, there's a song of yours and I can't remember exactly what it is, but it was like something about hands being so itchy that you wish they'd fall off.
Cut off my hands because they're itching so much. No,
is that, yeah.
I can't remember, it's end of last year. And it goes, yeah. Cut off my shoes instead of taking them off, cut off my hands because they're itching so much.
And I was like, oh, that's funny. I was like, it was a combination of like, oh, that's like some really funny imagery. And on the other hand, it's like this weirdly relatable thing. Like, I don't know, like I mean, like in a really kind of like, in a sort of, again, like in the most basic of ways, like I get eczema and I can like.
Yeah, no, that's where it came from. I had really, really bad eczema was where it, like that was the root of that.
Exactly. Exactly. So on the one hand, you're just like, oh my God, that's like, it's so true. It's like lines like that, which kind of has, you know, like they just, it's quite effortless. So it seems effortless, but it's really kind of touching and nice.
Yeah, I feel like there's, sometimes you just get a line that just comes into your head, and it often will come from something quite simple. And like, you know, that was very much like my feet were really itchy and I needed my shoes to like come off. And then my hands really itchy. And I was like, I'm so uncomfortable in my body. This is so intensely like horrible to have to experience this on my skin. And then it can be read in an emotional way, but it's also just very literal and it's very like immediate.
It's quite nice, like as well, it's quite like lazy as well.
Yeah.
You know, as a sentiment, I quite like it.
But in a way that works for you.
Yeah. It's a very lazy sentiment. There's another thing I was thinking about, and like, because it's something I kept talking about, because when I was doing the new record and I was trying to write like positive songs, and it doesn't come naturally to me at all. And I was like, so I was sort of forcing myself to write sort of like happy-go-lucky kind of lyrics in a way, and melodies and songs. And I was talking to people about it, and I was mentioning bands like REM, and I was mentioning like songs like Shiny Happy People, and I was saying how it was so
it's like these miserable but joyful songs that are,
yeah,
they do both at the same time.
Exactly. I wasn't necessarily like into REM when I was a teenager. It was because I was into like Nirvana, or I was into stuff which was like angsty.
But REM are as angsty, just in a very different way.
No, like totally they are. But at that age, I could not draw the line between like Michael Stipe and Kurt Cobain. I couldn't do it, you know what I mean? It seemed too different. But what I thought was interesting was how when I was listening to Nirvana and like indulging in the kind of angst of it, I was, I don't know, like 14, 15, 16, that kind of age. And Kurt Cobain was like 26, 25, 26, 27 or whatever. Well, maybe a bit older. And it suddenly recently made me realize, I was like, oh my God, like this, all of this angst, like coming from someone who's in their like 20s, like now as someone in my late 30s, it seems to me like, oh, what do these young people have to be anxious about? Like,
it's such an old man thing to say. Wow, you really
it's true. It's like, don't they know how good they've got
how
it?
How good they have it.
but what it made me realize is you'll never hear people like in their like late 30s writing angst ridden music, because I think it's like, it's a sort of, it's like a weird thing that you don't necessarily relate to unless you're younger. But anyways, I was thinking how me listening to your music and you being younger than me, it still has this effect on me that it would have had when I was, you know, in my teens.
I think there's some emotions that are just very base human emotions. There's some feelings that are just really universal, whether you are a child or an old man.
Like,
and I find that there's, you know, I feel like there's music that as you grow older, it takes a different place. Like, I feel like I could still go back to Nirvana now, and or like my equivalent of Nirvana, or like, you know, when I was younger, I listened to a lot of REM. I was really into them as a teenager, and then I think like listening to them now 15 years later, I'd still get a very raw emotional response to that. It feels like quite a compliment to you to say that, because I often try and make things that are more universal or that can be understood in kind of emotionally similar ways but in very different contexts.
I suppose what I was trying to say, that it's like interesting how a kind of younger person in music can have the appearance of someone that's like much more like worldly wise or kind of grown up emotionally, and how like someone who's much older than you could listen to your music but still within it hear something that like to them feels, you know what I mean, feels like a voice of like authority or something.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. That's a nice thing to hear.
Did you hear the new Mickey Blanco song?
I didn't. Is it really good? I do love Michael Stipe.
We got Michael Stipe on it, and it's like, it will be, apart from your singles and some of mine, it will be like the single of the year, I reckon.
Do you think?
Yeah. It's really nice hearing Michael Stipe's voice. And it's like, it's almost like he knows where it's going to do the good stuff. And yeah, it's a really, you should listen to it. After this, you should have a listen to it.
I will do. I feel like I have like a question that I'd kind of like half formed, but I wanted to ask you about the way that, like, when you write, do you find that you kind of go in with, now I haven't segued into this in any way, I've just kind of come straight in with this question, but because I feel like you're, like, we were talking about this a bit earlier, which is that the way that you write is that you've got kind of like your, whatever's happening in your life or whatever you've learned along the way, it all just kind of seeps in. You're not like trying to create boundaries or like block any particular element of your life off. But do you feel like you go into writing with an idea of what you're going to do, or like with a particular set of values in mind about how you're going to write? Because in your music, there's like something that is very kind of like specifically you. It's like a very unique and identifiable sound, which I think makes your music so good. But do you think about that before you do it? Or when you write, you're just kind of writing as not thinking about it?
It's changed quite a lot, you know. When I was writing like Nights Out or the earlier records, I was in quite a different place. I felt like I was part of a bunch of, like, part of something that was happening in London. And I felt like I was making exciting music. And so I remember thinking like, okay, well, it's like, I'm just trying to put everything that I like in music, I'm trying to put it into what I'm doing. And I think at that point, the sort of lyrics and stuff like that were like very secondary almost, but the funny thing about that was that because I wasn't thinking about them that much, they ended up being quite sort of straightforward and quite good because they were just not too considered or anything.
Yeah,
but I think now when I make music, I feel like, because I've been doing it for so long, I feel like I find it really hard to make it without sort of seeing it in some kind of like zoomed out way. I sort of see myself where I am now and where I have been and what I've done. And I find it hard to detach that from whatever I'm doing musically. So what I've tried to do more is to start really concentrating on lyrics. Because it's like I was saying about your, you know, like whether or not you think you care about lyrics, it's the most easy way into a song. And like when I was listening to your record, all of the bits, there are some obviously like really brilliant musical moments, but they kind of reveal themselves over a few listens. And actually it's like lyrics, which are just like, bam, like chopping your hands off because they're itchy. I like that one. I like
that one. Yeah, you like the eczema bits. Yeah. I'll send you all my eczema writings.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely write from like a vocal, like a lyrics of vocal. That's like what comes first for me in any song is a vocal melody and some words, and everything else comes after.
I have done that a bit over the like past whatever, however many years, but now I think that's definitely how I'm going to do stuff. And it kind of changes everything, I think, when you work like that.
Yeah, I guess it does. Maybe it would be interesting if I tried to write a song without any words. Maybe
just
that's riffs. My next
just
challenge.
Start, yeah, just like massive start with guitar riffs. Yeah.
Well, my least favorite song on the album, which maybe you can guess.
On my album?
No, on my album. I don't have a least favorite one on your album. Your album's great.
Ah, great. Thanks.
But like we have a song called Rotten on the new album, and that started off with a riff. And
but I like that one. That's about the apple. That was good.
That's the one about the apple. You're very good at this. Very smart.
Very smart. I think that's really cool. I like that one.
People love that. It's there because it's a lot of other people's favorites. But
I think you have to trust other people. You have to sort of.
Oh, yeah.
Often the song that you think is the best is like the one that everyone just skips over. And then they're like, but this one about the apple. I love it.
Yeah. Well, as Josh, my manager, says, people in photographs are the people who know what the photograph looks like the least. He probably said it in a better way than that. But I think it's the same with the song.
You know, I have got a good photograph analogy that you can tell him.
Okay, I'll write it down. I'll text him now.
Because sometimes people are asking about like, oh, what's it like when you kind of look back over your albums? And I was saying how it's like, oh, you know, it's like looking at photographs of yourself. If you look at it immediately, you're just like, oh my God, this is horrible. I look awful. But in about
10 years.
Yeah, you're like, oh wow, I look so nice and I look so young and I was so happy. And yeah, that's how I feel about my albums by now. I used to hate them.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Our first album, I for years couldn't listen to. And I listened to it the other night. And it's like an album we recorded in a shed with like song structures that kind of go everywhere. And it was just doesn't sound at all how I wanted it to. Listening to it the other night, I was like, this is like a great album. And it took me 7 years to be able to hear it and think that it was good.
Yeah. Time. It's a great healer, isn't it?
Time is the great and the greatest teacher. There was a really good quote on that note that I want to read you, which was well, we were in Copenhagen the other week and Sam from my band took me to see Kierkegaard's grave, and I was like listening to Kierkegaard podcasts, and it was just a quote that's, life can only be understood backwards but it must be lived forwards. And I was like, yeah, that's true. Thanks, yeah. Kierkegaard.
That's damn true. Yeah,
that is damn true. at his grave. Uh-huh. Yeah.
If I can come up with any quotes, no, but I can't, I don't think.
It's hard on the spot. And, you know, I only had that available because I just had it in front of me.
Because you got it tattooed on your arm.
Yeah, I got it tattooed on my ass, actually, after that. It was a lovely day in Copenhagen. Really nice time.
Oh, well, fair enough.
Very nice to speak to you. Thank you for some very thoughtful questions.
No problem. And congrats on the record. It's like seeing something like I was saying, like evolving in almost real time is really cool.
It's literally real time. That's what's fun, is that this is just life.
There you go.
And it's happening. It's happening right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And congratulations on your record.
Oh, thanks.
I really like it.
Thanks very much.
Well done.
Well, you're on it. You can't. Yeah. You have to like it.
That's true. Yeah.
Involved.
Yeah. Okay. Well, nonetheless, I do like it. And you did a great job.
Thank you very much.
And it was really fun to be on it and to come and get ice cream and pizza in Margate and have a fun time.
We should do it again, but maybe not in Margate.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll do it somewhere nicer next time.
Thanks for listening to the Talkhouse podcast, and thanks to Dana Margolin and Joseph Mount for chatting. If you like what you heard, please follow Talkhouse on your favorite podcast platform and all social media channels. This episode was produced by Myron Kaplan, and the Talkhouse theme is composed and performed by The Range. See you next time.